29. Hisha Chung stood in the vivarium, the early dawn casting a blue and indistinct light over her sister's garden. The smell was atrocious, ammonia and still, stale air. All around her, the garden lay in dark tatters. The two guards who escorted me covered their noses with claws to filter the dust raised by our feet.
"Have you found your gate back to the way yet?"
Chung asked, her voice tired but still acid. "No," I said. "I've come back to see where my friends are, a woman named Sherla, and Randall, the scientist who worked with Salep." Hisha said nothing for several seconds, then dismissed the guards with a wave, saying she knew me and I was no risk. The guards departed, and we were alone in the tainted stillness.
"You managed to get in here without being killed. That's a kind of magic," she said.
"I acted stupid and innocent," I said. "Lost."
"You may be the only innocent person on this planet," Chung said. "Innocence is a luxury for outsiders."
"Why are you here?" I asked.
"I don't want to watch the fighting."
"Where's Brian?"
"In Naderville. Maybe Bayes picked him up. Actually, I don't know where he is. Your woman and your friend Randall, I think Bayes took them with him on the ships."
I felt sick. "Why?"
"I don't follow Bayes closely. We don't like each other much."
She looked around her, staring at the dead garden with lips set in a rigid line.
"A balloon transporter dropped a few larval seed mothers here yesterday. All of Caitla's creations, dead in ours. The food supply, gone, rotted. There's probably very little food anywhere in Naderville by now. The air is filled with instructions from the green seed mothers, orders to die and rot in place to make nutrients for the new forms."
"You know for sure that Sherla and Randall aren't here?"
"I don't care where they are. We're all going to die unless Link wins and sends us food, or Brian wins and we all sail to Elizabeth's Land or Tasman. She did this to us."
Then, stepping closer and looking into my face, she said,
"You hate Brian, don't you?"
"Yes," I said. The emotions were not so clearly expressed, but to say anything else would have been lying.
"You'd kill him if you could?"
"No," I said.
"And Bayes?"
"I'm not here to kill," I said.
"You think Brian's weak now, and Bayes is going to return and take over completely?"
"He already has, hasn't he?" Hisha Chung bit her lip, her eyes filling with tears.
"I feel what Caitla would feel," she said. "Everything wasted, all the suffering and dying. She was devoted to Brian. He loved her very much. But love doesn't excuse us, does it?"
"No."
"You have judged us, haven't you?"
"Not you," I said. "I don't know much about you."
"An accomplice," she murmured. "Will Lenk take us back with him?"
"I don't know," I said. She touched her finger to her cheeks and smeared her tears.
"You don't believe in drama, do you? Brian believes in drama, too much, I think. But Bayes is like you. He has your woman and your friend. Maybe he'll be expecting you. Go kill Bayes."
30. Dawn had turned the sky gray-green in the east. The guards stood by the main gate into the old palace, saying nothing, holding their rifles with barrels raised a few degrees above horizontal as I walked away. I expected a bullet in my back at any moment. The path back through the buildings to the road was deserted. The troops from the citadel had departed hours ago. On the Godwin Road, heading west, I found two bodies in the barren fields. Brock, lying face down in the dirt, had been shot in the chest and jaw. Yuke, the fast young runner, lay on the other side of the road a few meters away, on her back, calm eyes staring at the dusty morning sky. Ahead and behind, the thicket Silva made ugly groaning and rattling sounds, settling, throwing up billows of gray dust. The tunnel was a nightmare, dust falling all around in drifts like ash, sections half collapsed, the air almost unbreathable. I thought I would suffocate before I stumbled out into daylight again. Behind me, the tunnel collapsed, and I was surrounded by a thick cloud of acrid powder and ammonia. I closed my eyes and ran clear, then lay gasping on my knees by the road, eyes burning, covered with clinging grime. My skin itched furiously. I had sent Brock to his death. I had guided Yuke and perhaps the others into death, and I did not know if I had accomplished anything. The soldiers had passed through the roads and might be in Naderville even now, fighting Keo's unprepared young men and women. Link would lose. Baze would command. I pictured Sherla already dead and Randall with her. As I lurched along the road, rubbing the skin on my arms and chest and head, I stopped my scratching long enough to reach up to the skies and shout, "Come take me now! Where are you? Take me now!" I think I was asking for a gate to open, but I might have been asking to die. 31. Janos and I have settled in a secluded district of the Vald. We are eating a midday meal and sharing a bottle of wine. I have paused from my story, trying to keep my composure, even after all these decades and into the full-grown infancy of a new life. Janos fills in for a few minutes with tales of his months as assistant to the presiding minister. Then we drift in silence. And finally, as if to get me going again, he says, "I'm listening." This is a part I know I will have great difficulty describing. It has been 60 years and more since that day, by the time of my older body, now abandoned somewhere, all of its history so much useless tissue. "The town wasn't pretty, was it?" Janos asks. "The ships had destroyed about half of it. The soldiers from the old palace fought their way through the eastern part of town to go north. There was still fighting in the north. The battle between Lenk's troops and the soldiers from the old palace, quick and bloody. I found Keo dead, and two of his boys stumbling around through the bodies of their friends. Lenk had not sent reinforcements." Janos looks off across the green expanses of grass and spherical trees and huge thick vines and long interwoven tree trunks that form a lacework around the perimeter of the weightless vault. "Some would say that such destruction is trivial compared to what's happened between us and the Jarts. There was a time 2 years ago when we thought they would capture Axis City." I shake my head in violent disagreement. Nothing that fills an eye with horror is trivial. It was on a scale that I could almost get used to it. That horrified me. "Lenk had been building weapons for some time then," Janos says. "In secret." He didn't think Baze or Brian would listen. He made cannons out of cathedral tree limbs, hardened by heating over fire and then steaming. They could only shoot 4 or 5 times, but he filled his ships with replacements. I don't like talking tactics and logistics. That has all become vague and uninteresting to me. When humans set their minds on something, when we are forced into a corner, we can work miracles of destruction. "Tell me what happened to Sherla. She must have been a fascinating woman. She was simple. When I was with her, I was simple. Tell me," Janos says. "I am back in Naderville again. It is remarkably the same as my first hours in Moonrise. I am back where I began in Lamarckia." Bodies lay in the streets, men and women, a few children. Brian had valued his citizens, and especially children, so much, needing them for a future on Lamarckia, that he later abandoned. And here were so many, wasted, and the bodies of Keo and his young men and women lying with them. The fighting had been fierce, and Keo had taken many with him. I walked through the streets, weeping, and finally I would not look at the dead. Medical teams, I did not know whether they were Brianists or civilians, had set up camps in the center of town at the base of a low hill, and I carried a few injured people there from the blocks nearby that had been shelled into utter rubble. Nobody asked who I was or where my sympathies lay. Naderville was finished. Brian's political movement was at an end. All around the city the Silva was turning gray and crumbling. The great dark thickets were collapsing. Roads were being cut off by falling debris. Balloons were dropping their cargo, and some had even fallen in the rubble of the town. I had to go where the fighting was. I heard shots and more cannon fire to the north, so after doing what little I could at the eastern end of town, I walked north. Empty buildings, shattered houses and markets, warehouses, the ruins of the administration building. I passed them all, my thoughts clearing again. From the top of the western hill, I looked across the harbor and saw one steamship coming around the western headland, leaving a trail of gray smoke. Most of Lenk's ships had left the harbor. Only four remained, and they immediately fired broadsides on the steamship. Several shells made direct hits. The steamship's guns were still active, however, and it closed. The big guns boomed once, and the direct hit on the southernmost of Lenk's vessels broke the ship in half. The remaining three ships had reloaded and fired again. The steamship took two more hits, and for a few minutes it slowed and followed a gentle curve to the middle of the harbor. My heart rose. I hoped it was disabled. But again the guns fired, fore and aft, and two more ships took large shells, one in the middle, one forward, blowing the bow off. One ship remained. I did not want to see any more, but I could not leave. There was an even chance that Sherla and Randall were aboard the steamship, that they had already been injured or killed by the cannon shells. The last of the sailing ships in the harbor fired two more cannon shots. The first raised a tower of spray 50 meters in front of the steamship. The second blew the bridge to pieces. The steamship drifted, first left, then right, leaving a frothing wake, and then settled against a sandbar and rolled on its side. The stern sank below water. The remaining sailing ship stood out in the harbor triumphant, but only for a moment. Fire had started on her deck and was spreading swiftly. The trees and furled sails caught and flared, and smoke drifted across the harbor to the south. I had had enough. I walked another block along Sun Street to where I could see the northern edge of the peninsula on which Naderville sat. A thick fog covered the ocean there, but through the fog I heard more cannon fire and saw a bright orange flash. A mushroom puff of smoke and flying debris rose above the ceiling of fog, about 3 kilometers from the shore. A deafening thud went off, seemingly at my feet. I swiveled and looked to my left, along the northwestern extent of the peninsula. A lazy curl of smoke and the residue of flame still hung from where a large gun had been fired. It had been dragged on a wheeled carriage along a dirt road and was now mounted under camouflage, backed up against thick, low-lying arborids at the top of the hill west of where I stood. I wondered who commanded the gun, and quickly decided it must be Baze's forces. The fog would soon be lifting. Somewhere out there, very likely, was the second steamship wreaking havoc on Lenk's sailing ships. The gun was useless for now, firing once just for practice, but when the fog lifted, it would quickly finish the job. I ran down a street to the east, past bewildered civilians returning to this part of town now that the shelling and fighting had subsided. I encountered the first pickets for Lenk's troops on the outskirts of the low hills. I knew they belonged to Lenk because they wore no uniforms, as Baze's troops did, and because their discipline had broken completely. They saw I was unarmed and were too exhausted to pay me much attention. The fighting here had also been vicious, and bodies littered the thin scrub of fightids and arborids in the fields around the hills. A few shacks had been reduced to rubble, and men and women, mostly men, rested while others went among them with water and medicine. Moans and shrieks broke out from the wounded, laid out in rows on the ground, watched over by exhausted medical attendants. It looked like any ancient battle, any fragment of war long past, something I had once thought would never be possible for humans again, and certainly not humans born in Thistledown. I came upon four men standing together beside a lone stone wall, passing a bottle. They eyed me suspiciously as I approached. "Who's in charge?" I asked. "Nobody now," one of the men said. "The ranks are back on the Cape or dead. We're waiting to be called back to wherever. Who are you?" I told them my name and pointed out that a gun was in place and would soon be firing on the fleet. I was about to lay out a plan for taking the gun, knowing I had to begin somewhere, when a fleshy man with a patchy beard and thick eyebrows lifted a thick fist and poked his finger at me. "You're the Hexamon agent, aren't you?" he asked. "You're going to bring a gate down and take us back to Thistledown." I stared at him for a moment, taken by surprise, not sure what to say or do. "We're sick of this," the fleshy man said. "I killed 4 people today. I killed a woman. That's mortal error." He backed away, head dropping. "I killed a woman." "You can't take us back now, can't you? The youngest in the group reached out to grab my arm. Battle shock and hope gave his face a pallid glow.
"We need to go home. Something awful is happening here. Can't you smell it?"
"Are you what they say?" the tallest and oldest of them asked. He was about my age, and he had bandages wrapped around his arm and leg.
"I don't know what we'd do if you turned out to be a lie."
I heard a commotion behind us. A few men with rifles ran to confront an approaching group of uniformed Bryanists, 10 or 12 in all. They held several white flags and carried no weapons. They were quickly surrounded, and the shouting died down into tense discussion, gun barrels pushed against hands held up, palms out, heads leaning, subdued words passing quickly.
"They can't be surrendering," the bandaged man growled. "They're just resting before they push us back out to the headland."
I heard wind-blown scraps of the conversation and walked toward the group. Again I felt the queasy excitement, the tingling sense that something significant was happening.
"That's him," one of the Bryanists said, pointing at me as I approached the crowd.
I recognized the officer who had addressed the ship's crews at the Citadel and tried to remember his name. Pitt, I thought. His uniform was torn and covered with mud. He approached me with hands outstretched.
"I know who you are. Word has been passing everywhere that you're here."
He stared at me with wolf-like intensity.
"Your name is Olmi. You know what's happening. The Silva is dying. You know."
My hands seemed to pulse. "I know," I said, letting some deeper instinct, deeper personality take over.
"You came with the troops from the Citadel?" Pitt nodded. "We fought west of here."
He glanced at the encircling men and women, eyes jerking back and forth between stiff, unsympathetic faces.
"The thicket is dying. We can smell it. Scions are crawling out everywhere and dying. The food is rotting in the storage houses."
"Are you in charge?" I asked.
"I am a captain, rank second over my company."
"Are you done fighting?"
"What good is it? What can we do?" he asked plaintively. "The food is going bad. The food in our kits is turning into dust. Since last night, all the food from the Silva, all of it. We rely on it. There is so little of anything else."
Most of the able-bodied men and women on the hill, about 150 of them, had gathered around looking to me for explanations. Voices clamored for answers. I saw the gray Bryanist uniforms absorbed in the motley of Lynx soldiers, exhaustion and battle and common fear removing the last barriers. I felt a roaring in my ears, and my vision tunneled for a moment as blood pumped into head. I found a low broken wall and climbed precariously on top of the ragged stones.
"Listen!" I shouted, raising my hands. "Sir Brian has let loose something new on Shea. I spoke with him. I saw it. The Ecos is in a major fluxing. In a few days or weeks there isn't going to be any food from the Ecos, and very few are going to be able to survive here. The battle is over." "It's dying," voices cried out. "We have to let everybody know so the fighting will stop."
"We don't have any more radios," the bandaged man shouted at me. "The ranks have them."
I looked down at Pitt.
"Do you have radios?" I asked.
He shook his head.
"They're controlled by General Baze's attachés," he said.
"Where is Baze?" I asked.
"On the 15, Pitt said, pointing north. "They're going to sink the rest of Lenk's fleet. They hope to catch Lenk and kill him as well."
"Abel Lenk," a woman muttered. I could not tell whether she was correcting Pitt's disrespect or expressing her own. I bent over on the wall and put my hand on Pitt's shoulder. I had managed to lose all sense of my limitations. A small rational voice told me, "Now you really are like Lenk and Brian." But there was nothing else I could do, nothing else to be done, but follow the inner pressure. I had fleshed out a legend, once half-dreaded, a bogeyman of another place and time. I could feel a coalescing, upturned faces, despair and hope and weariness all around me, weaknesses and passions into which I could fit like a plug in a socket, and where no one else could fit so well.
"How many soldiers will follow you?" I asked Pitt. 50, he said. "They're waiting for me to come back. I remembered you when the word started spreading. There was a message from the Citadel telling about you. Some others saw you walking through the town.
I scanned the crowd again for the face of the bandaged soldier. Saw so many bandages, so many wounds, and dirty, frightened faces. Found the man again. I fixed on him.
How many here will follow me? What are we going to do? The bandaged man asked.
There's a large gun on a hill below us. It's going to help Bay's sink Link's ships. We need those ships. We need to capture that gun.
Pitt's face wrinkled again, this time in genuine anguish. I bent down again and shook his shoulder firmly.
You've come here for a reason, I said. Bayes will never give up, will he?
I don't know what Bayes will do, Pitt said.
I picked up the phrase the fleshy bearded man had used.
Bayes has led you into mortal error.
Pitt closed his eyes and took a deep breath, brows squeezed together.
If the ships are sunk, what can we do? I asked.
They won't need the gun. 15 can destroy most of the ships by itself.
Pitt's face gleamed one last time with esprit de corps.
Link slipped his ships into the harbor when our steamships were out to sea. Bayes came back as soon as he heard, and Link ordered his ships out of the harbor. But Bayes pushed them up against the bight north of the peninsula, and now the ships are as good as sunk.
Bayes will never give up, I repeated.
A quiet fell over the crowd. Those attached to Link knew the truth of this, and the soldiers of Bayes and Brian were absorbing the implications.
Sir Brian did this? Voices among the gray and tan uniforms asked. He poisoned the Silva?
Heads shook and bitter whispers passed. Pitt roused himself, making a decision with a quick spasm of his body.
There was a rebellion 2 years ago. We felt the Ecos might have been profaned. We warned him and his Caitla Chung, but then Brian brought us the food. We were hungry.
The crowd absorbed this information in silence. I examined the faces, trying to find where the river of consent and passion would flow. A wrong word, a jarring phrase, could shatter this crowd like a crystal vase. The Brianist soldiers would be beaten to death, the battle would resume, and I would be able to accomplish nothing. I thought of common sufferings and deep fears.
No more food, I said.
Join us! The bandaged man shouted. The crowd coursed around me, arms raised, hands gripping in the air. I could hardly believe what I was seeing. The crowd had become one and was ready to absorb more.
32. The gun, Pitt informed us, was approachable only by the dirt road. The fog north of the peninsula was already thinning. Patches of ocean and a few ships revealed, and morning was giving way to noon. We had Pitt's 50 soldiers, and keeping well behind them, 50 of Link's troops, all of them now following me. I considered the situation carefully. If we put the gun out of action, Bayes' steamship could still cause considerable damage to Link's fleet. With 4 ships sunk in the harbor, having taken the 43 down with them, there were 10 vessels still in the fog at severe risk. The situation was also clear to Pitt. He sat on a rock at the bottom of the hill road just below a detachment in place to guard the road. The detachment had already exchanged a few words with Pitt and recognized him. I sat beside Pitt. Christoph Absaja, the bandaged man, stood behind us.
I can talk to them some more, Pitt said, but I don't know what good it will do. They're a special crew. They take orders directly from Bayes and no one else. After the steamships, that gun is his pride.
We don't have much time, I said. The gun blasted a great gout of flame and smoke from the side of the hill. The shell flew out over the water, sounding like a huge shoe grinding boulder-sized gravel. Seconds later, kilometers away, an explosion answered like the same heavy shoe dropping.
It can shoot 7 kilometers, Pitt said. Maybe more.
We may have to kill them, Saja said. Pitt lowered his face into his hands and rubbed his eyes.
It's not easy, he said.
To kill them? Saja asked.
To be a traitor, he replied sharply, and looked up at me, eyes pleading for some sort of inspiration. I had put myself into this position. I could not back down now.
I listened intently to the conflicting messages inside me, trying to find that conviction of invincibility I had known before. My neck hair tingled again. Interest. the word that described so much and explained so little.
I heard more voices coming from the flat between the hills, mostly female. The bearded man, Hamsun, ran up to join us. The detachment farther up the dirt road began to mill restlessly, weapons raised, sensing something was about to happen.
"Women," Hamsun said out of breath, panting heavily. "From Naderville. Older women coming back, now that the fighting has stopped."
In a town or city as small as Naderville, everybody should know everybody else. They had shared mutual grief and misery. I tried to imagine the depth of the social connections, the influence some people might wield. Bayes might have been a true aberration, his support shallow. The dull calm on the face of the man in the flatboat could as easily have been numb acquiescence. And now the women were here, perhaps the mother or wife of that man. For a moment I felt lost in this new sympathy. All the energetic loathing I had carried left a confusing vacuum.
"Sir Pitt," I said, "can you explain things to the women? Bring some of them up here? You want them to go up the road first?"
"Mothers, sisters, wives," I said. Pitt stood.
"I'll try to explain," he said. "I know some of the gun crew. I know their families."
"Janosch is trying to absorb this."
"So you became a general," he said. "You learned how to move the masses."
His words are ironic, perhaps a little disbelieving. Pitt and I walked with the women. We walked up the road. The soldiers could not shoot their own women.
"You told them about the food," Janosch says.
"It was more than food," I say. "It was exhaustion and 37 years of frustration and recrimination and misery. And now the profanation of a sacred thing."
"That is what I have the most trouble understanding," Janosch says. "How could anyone revere such a thing as the Ecos? Wasn't it part of their misery?"
"No," I say, not knowing exactly how to explain. "Janosch will never see the Ecoi as they were. Nobody will ever see them again."
The women walked past the guards and the chain barrier and up to the gun. Lenk's troops stayed behind. They were not necessary. The gun crew were not the devoted warriors Bayes might have hoped. They succumbed rapidly to the pleas of their wives and mothers and radioed for instructions to 15. Bayes could not explain the fluxing to his soldiers, nor why they should continue supporting Brian when the sustenance of their homeland was rotting. The gun did not fire again. Bayes had lost his constituency, and word was spreading against Brian. Pitt sat with me afterward, and the captain of the gun crew joined us in the shadow of the big weapon, looking out across the ocean at the steamship and Lenk's bottled-up fleet. The captain tossed his hat down into the dust beside the massive wheel.
"I have two young ones," he said, glancing at me like a shy, frightened child. "My wife didn't come here with the others."
He swung his hand at the women on the road and surrounding the emplacement.
"If they're still alive, where will they go? What will they eat? I tried to speak with Bayes, but he hasn't answered the radio since we stopped firing."
"Is there a boat?" I asked.
"On the beach," the captain said, pointing down the hill.
The launch had once served the government's needs on the northern side of the peninsula. Less fancy than Brian's launch or Chang's, it still had a fully charged set of batteries and a sturdy electric motor. Pitt stepped aboard with me, carrying a radio from the gun crew. Hamsun followed. Sager would stay behind to keep the peace between the Lenk troops, the gun crew, and the rest of the Brianist soldiers, many seeing their wives and mothers for the first time in days. On the beach beside the launch lay wilted gray devastation. The beachfront thicket had died. A balloon had dropped the last of its green larval seed mothers and now lay half-collapsed on the spit of black sand and lava gravel nearby, pushed at by slow, persistent waves. The new, young seed mother had taken residence in a tangle of phytids the night before and had immediately enslaved them to protect itself against whatever weather there might be. They had formed a small shelter over its delicate green body, and in the middle, beneath the canopy, it grew and sent forth broad, flat green folia, spreading wide in the afternoon sun. The balloon's wrinkled, rapidly deflating bag rolled back and forth in the low surf. As we prepared to board the launch,
The green center beneath the dry, crumbling protection of the phytids exploded and threw out tiny corn kernel grains. They immediately pushed probing tendrils into the dirt and wet sand. Pitt regarded the new ecos with disgust. I did not bother to tell him what it was. We had little time. The steamship sailed in a tight loop 4 kilometers offshore. The last of the sailing ships that had dropped off Lenk's troops and shelled Naderville had gotten themselves into a tight situation, bottled up in a bight that stretched 7 kilometers north from the peninsula. It was obvious from the steamship's threatening posture and strategic position that if they tried to leave, they would be shelled, probably demolished. But for the time being, no action was being taken. The sailing ships could not shell 15 at its present distance from them, but it could certainly fire on them, and Bayes seemed to be weighing his options. Hampson and Pitt insisted that they be allowed to run the boat. "You need time to think," Pitt said. His deference made me nervous. Again, all my confidence had fled. The way Pitt looked at me made my stomach churn. I dreaded the thought of meeting with Bayes. I knew his kind of evil would rise above any small talent I might have at persuasion and politics. He would know I was no prophet. He might simply shoot me or order me shot. I did not fear that, however. Death seemed the least of my worries. I hoped Shirla was on board and Randall. On the other hand, I was uncomfortable at the thought of her seeing me in this new false role of diplomat and putative avatar. She would instantly know it for the sham it was. If Bayes saw her reaction, he would know then also. And yet, what could Bayes do? He could kill us. He could fire on the sailing ships. But Lenk and the Coragos were not in the bite. Without support from Naderville, Bayes was nothing more than a pirate. His strength would rapidly wane. The situation in Naderville was far from stable, however. Brian could reappear at any moment, from wherever he was hiding, and draw his people back together, back to their accustomed ruler and ways. He was far better at playing his role than I could be. Bayes might be in touch with Brian. The pair of supposed opposites might again be drawing lines of force between them, North Pole and South, on the brink this time of regaining not just Naderville, but all the other human settlements as well. Pitt had told the steamship that we were approaching, and that I was aboard to parley. He stood beside me on the prow. Hampson piloted the boat from the stern. "Will he blow us out of the water?" Pitt asked. "I was just about to ask you the same thing," I said. "I feel sick to my stomach," Pitt said. "So do I." Pitt squinted up at me. "The general is a powerful man," he said. "I think he'll squash me like a bug." "What does he believe in?" I asked. Pitt frowned. He was a thin, weary bureaucrat in a uniform that no longer seemed to fit him. His long wrists hung out of the sleeves, and he clasped his bony hands together tightly. "A few hours ago I would have said he believed in Brian and Naderville, in bringing rational planning and thought to Lamarckia. I was a student in the academy before my enlistment began and the call-up put us all in uniform. I didn't see any duty away from Naderville. I stayed here and watched things change. Brian became more aloof, Bayes more prominent. I did not disapprove. Should I have?" I shook my head. If I could not judge Brian, surely I could not judge this man or any like him. The confusing vacuum persisted. No right, no wrong, only forces of nature, like winds blowing us back and forth. My stomach knotted tighter. We were less than a kilometer from 15. The steamship had slowed. She had dropped a sea anchor to maintain her position. Pitt rubbed his nose and said that was a good sign. 15's given us permission to put alongside," Hampson called from aft. Pitt arranged his uniform and smoothed back his hair, blown about by the sea breeze. The smell of ammonia and flat staleness was apparent even this far from shore. On the land it must have been awful. "Some of us worshipped Shea," Pitt said. "It wasn't her fault she couldn't feed us. Some thought she did what she could, that we had just overstepped our bounds. That's why so many were upset when Brian said he was going to make her fruitful, he was going to change her. Brian almost lost everything then. But he brought the food down the canal in ships, and we had been so hungry for so long. The rebellion ended before it really got started. The last 2 days? I don't know. I've lived here all my life. The thicket Silva's been here for millions of years, so they say. I think if I were someone else, I'd cry. How could Brian have done something like this? I could not give any useful answers. The launch pulled alongside the steamship, and a gangway was lowered level with our deck. We lashed the launch to the gangway and climbed the steps. A narrow-faced man with a short, stiff cap of brown hair greeted us stiffly at the rail. "General Bays is busy now. He'll be with you shortly." We were taken forward, past the big forward gun, sea-based twin of the gun that had been rolled up the hill. It must have taken immense effort to make such weapons, and yet they had not saved 43 from being sunk by primitive Xyla-wrapped cannon. I could not fathom the reasoning behind such a military buildup. Had Brian or Bays anticipated a major showdown at sea? The bristle-haired man introduced himself as Major Somfa, then sat us under an observation canopy erected in front of the forward gun. "Is it as bad as it looks?" he asked softly, nodding in the direction of the mainland. From where 15 floated, the stretches of Silva looked pale and irregular, the sharply defined boundaries turning ash gray as the day progressed. "It's all changing," Pitt said. "What's the worst of it? We haven't heard much." "The food," Pitt said. Hampson described the situation in the storage barns. Major Somfa took it with as much stoic calm as he could muster, but it obviously hit him hard. He asked about his family in Naderville. "Some are coming back into town, but..." Hampson shook his head. "Are you with Link?" Somfa asked me. "No," I said. "He says he's from the Hexamon," Pitt said. "A lot of people believe him." Somfa nodded, putting facts together and drawing his own conclusions. "I think General Bays believes him," he said. "Why let you come here otherwise? We're waiting for nightfall, and then we'll sink Link's ugly fleet one by one." "There's no food," Pitt growled. "What good will it do to sink the ships that might take some of us away, or bring food from Tasman or Elizabeth?" "Link wouldn't do a thing for us before," Somfa said. "I need to know if there are two people on board," I interrupted, my patience ending. "A man and a woman. One is named Shirla Apnam, the other is Erwin Randall." "The hostages," Somfa said. "They're here. Bays is keeping them below. Maybe he is worried about you." He shrugged and left us sitting out of the milky sunlight in the shade of the canopy. An hour passed, and Somfa returned with glasses of water. He stood with us for several minutes, grimly staring across the water at the ash-colored shore. "Looks like a huge fire hit it," he said. "Do you think it's happening everywhere?" "It will," I said. "We'll put into the harbor tomorrow morning after we sink these ships, if it's clear," Somfa said. "I need to see things for myself." An hour later, he returned again. The distant shore appeared creamy white in the late afternoon light. The sun crept toward the western horizon. Within the bight, the remains of Link's fleet had anchored. To the men and women on those ships, I thought it must seem as if the world was ending. They'd probably try to break out in an hour or so, and chance that Bays's monster would miss a few, not be able to track them down, or that they could return sufficient fire to put the steamship out of action. I imagined myself on one of those ships. "General Bays says he's ready to meet with you now," Somfa said. We stood, and Somfa placed himself in front of me. "If you are the judge from the Hexamon, I need to tell you something now. My wife and I were ordered to take in 3 children from Elizabeth's land," he said. "We were ordered to. We have taken good care of them." We looked at each other for a long moment, and then Somfa turned away, murmuring, "I just wanted you to know that." He led us to the bridge, up a steep companionway and around an outside passage to cabins on the upper deck. Somfa opened a door, and an imposing dark woman, taller than I and probably stronger, stared at us with sharp, clear eyes, then stood aside. General Bays sat at a table within the cabin. All was painted white, and the table was set with a white cloth. A glass pitcher of water and several cups had been placed around the table, and folding Xyla chairs drawn up. Bays looked at the man beside me. "You're rank 2 Suleiman Pitt. I don't remember this man's name. Hampson, sir. Tarvo Hampson.
Is it as bad on shore as it looks?
Yes, sir, Pitt said. Bayes indicated we should sit. His ruddy cheeks had blued to a pale violet in the last few days, and his skin was sallow from fatigue. His left hand trembled slightly on the white cloth of the table until he removed it and hid it beneath the table.
Brian should have killed you all and Link days ago, Bayes said. We had Link in our hands. We both miscalculated badly.
What good to kill more? I asked.
My mistake, Bayes said shortly, his voice clipped but calm. I underestimated Link, and in my profession, that's a crime.
He leaned forward.
Still no help from the Hexamon? Link's clavicle no good for you?
I haven't seen it, I said.
Brian took you up the canal and showed you more than you cared to see, I'll bet.
He took us up the canal, I said.
The scientist, Salop, what did he think?
He's still there.
Is Brian responsible for what's happening on shore? He and his wife?
It looks that way, I said.
He knew, damn him, Bayes said, looking up at the ceiling, then back at me. He behaved like a kid whose dirty little secrets are going to come out soon. Do you know where he is?
I shook my head.
Neither do I. I can't reach him by the radio, and no one on shore has seen him.
Bayes leaned back and glared at Pitt and Hampson.
Get out, he ordered loudly.
They stood quickly, and the imposing dark woman escorted them through the hatch.
Afra, shut the door behind you and stay outside yourself.
Yes, sir, the woman said.
Bayes put both hands on the table.
We're equal now. Fate damn either one of us who lies.
All right, I said.
The oath assumed, he added, staring at me with brows drawn together.
The oath assumed.
Brian gave you the impression that I'm responsible for all the mayhem, didn't he? Bayes asked.
I believe you carried out your interpretation of vague orders.
Bayes thrust his jaw out and leaned his head back. Did Brian show you the army he wanted to make? Or rather, have the Seed Mother make? Designs for Scion soldier weapons?
He read my features intently.
No, I said.
His face shifted from a wry smile to disgust.
He wanted to start over again. He wanted all of Link's people to realize what Link had done to us. Anything to further that cause was legitimate. We were working to stabilize all settlements on Lamarckia, to transform this planet. Food was the first accomplishment. The Scion soldiers would have been next, but his wife died. That broke him. I thought he was strong or I wouldn't have allied with him, but that broke him.
Bayes met my silence with a lift of his lip and a cluck of his tongue.
If I destroy this fleet of links in the next hour, what will you do?
I avoided directly answering that question, instead explaining about the larval seed mothers, the rotting scions of old Shea.
Everyone in Naderville will starve, I said.
If I let Link go free, and whatever you might think is honorable or just, what will you do?
Naderville will need to be evacuated. That could take months. A lot of people will die, but not all of them.
Bayes considered this, rubbing his cheek with a short, fat finger. Then he lifted one eyebrow.
What would you have done if you were me?
Why did you kill so many? I asked in return.
Bayes jerked slightly in his chair, but his expression did not change.
Why kill the adults? I asked, taking another angle.
Irrational loyalty to Link and all he stood for, he said.
Yes, but why kill them?
To end the old and begin the new. How would you have done that if you were me?
You really don't know why you ordered them killed, do you?
Bayes lowered his eyelids until he resembled a sleepy farm animal, a dog or a pig.
You judge me. Have you judged Brian?
I'm not a judge, I said.
Brian believed you were powerless, he said. He thought you were a gnawed-off piece of some aborted effort. I told him the Hexamon does not work that way. He laughed and said I was an idealist. I think that all you have to do is wink just the right way, and all this will end.
Why not wink?
I did not answer. He refused to look me in the eye, and I saw sweat on his lip.
"I have something for you. Brian asked that I take your companions, Ap-Nam and Randall, with me on this ship. He learned that you and Ap-Nam were lovers. They're here."
"I'd like to see them," I said. Bayes clenched his hands on the table and knocked it sharply with his knuckles.
"I would have done anything to have never come here. I would have worked my way up in Way Defense." His voice tensed. "I am in a backwater with nowhere to go. When my family died, Brian was all I had."
"Show me Sherla and Irwin," I said.
"If I give them up to you and let the fleet go, what then?"
I did not hesitate to tell a half-lie. "I will not turn you over to Hexamon Justice."
"Where will I live?"
"Wherever you can travel without my help." Bayes mulled this over.
"You can have this ship. It's hell to maintain. I can take one of Lenk's schooners and a crew of 10. I can manage with 10. If you want, I'll sink this ship."
"We'll need all the ships," I said. His once florid face had taken on the cast of wet free-chunk paste.
Bayes lifted his eyes to meet mine. "A small ship, a boat. Where do you suggest I go?"
"I don't care," I said.
"Lenk might have shelled his own children, you know," Bayes murmured. "They might have been kept in Naderville as protection."
"Were they?"
"If I had thought about it, I would have ordered them kept there, but I was 60 miles out at sea when the attack began. I was going to Jakarta and then to Athenai."
I shook my head.
"I stay here on Lamarckia, whatever happens. You will not let them take me back to the Way."
"All right," I said. Bayes brought his hands up on the table. Star, fate, and Numa be kind, I shook hands with that man.
Sherla and Randall stood in the shadow of the aft gun, guarded by 3 soldiers in gray and tan, and Pitt and Hampson waited nearby. I walked along the passage to the rear deck. Sherla saw me and ran forward. Nobody tried to stop her. She grabbed me and I squeezed her tightly, burying my face in her neck and sweat-scented hair. We said nothing for a time.
"Are you a prisoner, too?" she asked.
"I don't think so," I said.
"Are we going back to Liz now? I keep hearing that we can't possibly stay here, that the Ecos is sick."
So word was spreading around the ship.
I wondered if Bayes or Brian could possibly survive.
"I hope we can go, and soon," I said. "There's a lot of work to do, a lot to prepare for."
"No magic?" she asked.
I shook my head. "I'm afraid not."
"Just you?"
"Just me," I said.
Randall came closer and joined us. "I hope you'll be enough," he said.
33. Janosch and I have made our way to my newly assigned apartment. He has to leave soon. The presiding minister has been affording him considerable time to arrange for my care and debrief me, but other matters are pressing hard, and Janosch can assign only so many incorporeal ghosts to do his work before his embodied authority becomes necessary. Much has changed in the Hexamon in 10 years. The art of ghosting, of projecting partial personalities to do one's work, has advanced to astonishing sophistication. "Did you ever learn why Lenk destroyed the clavicle?" Janosch asks. Sherla was with me when we went ashore in Lenk's main party to pay homage to the dead. Brian, Hisha, Chung, and Frick had been found murdered, their bodies mutilated. Lenk claimed disgruntled soldiers from Brian's army had caught them and killed them. I never heard any reason to believe otherwise. Their alleged killers were going to be put on trial in Tasman. They were being buried with a full divaricate Naderite funeral, allowing Lenk to show that time and honor can heal all wounds. A few days later, the Koragos departed Shia. Because of the extraordinary fluxing, boats were being sent from Tasman and Elizabeth's land, and some effort was being made to evacuate the citizens of Naderville. It would take months, and Lenk did not want to be there if things went wrong. He insisted Sherla and I accompany him to Tasman. Bayes left Naderville in a small schooner with a 5-man crew, all that would go with him. None was ever heard from again. Sherla sat on the deck of the Koragos in a small folding chair sipping from a bowl of tea. She smiled up at me as I approached, afraid but trying hard not to show her fear. I sat beside her and she offered me the cup. I took a sip.
When is he going to show us?
She asked. Tonight. He's busy arranging things now. He's still Abel Link. Shirley gazed out to sea, and her teeth began to chatter. With a jerk, she stilled the quiver in her jaw and looked miserable.
You'll be going soon, she said.
There had been so little time to talk, so many meetings and arrangements before leaving Shea. None of this had been worked over between us. I don't think so, I said.
If you can fix the clavicle,
Ferrier says he doesn't believe that's possible now.
But if you can, you'll go back to the way.
I took her hand. I don't know what will happen.
You come from a larger place than anything I can conceive of, Shirla said. I've been taught all of my life to be afraid of that place, to despise it. Now you're my love, and you come from there.
We all come from there, I said.
But I don't want to leave here. You must.
I squeezed her hand. In truth, nobody knew what would happen. He wants you to be there too, I said.
Good Lenk invited me?
He did.
Only,
she said, putting her other hand over mine.
I wanted...
She tried valiantly again.
I wanted...
Tears dripped down her cheeks.
I wanted...
She managed again and shook her whole upper body to rid herself of this foolishness.
Never, ever, ever want anything with all your life, ever. Never want. They will take it away. You will go away.
I want to. I know where I am now, I said.
Who are you?
She asked. Lenk sat in the cabin where we had met, it seemed, years earlier. Ulrika Facet stood beside him, but left as Shirla and I came in. On the table before him was an ornate Xyla box.
Nobody can offer any proof that you are from the Hexamon, he said as we sat in two chairs opposite.
That is remarkable. I accept that you are because of what you have done. I know the ways of history, and it all smells right to me. He turned to Shirla. You are a good woman, and have never wanted more than to have a family and live a decent life.
Shirla blinked at him, then looked at me, too stunned to answer.
Isn't that so? There's no need to be shy.
She nodded. It was so.
Lenk knew his people well. You have made love with this man in a certain way, under difficult circumstances, and that means you are committed to him and believe he is committed to you. Do you accept him for what he is?
I don't think we came here to talk about that, Shirla said softly.
Lenk focused his deep-set, dark-lidded eyes on me. For a moment he looked remarkably like a dead man. I hear that Brian and Baze thought you could pass judgment, that Baze worried you would split him like a ripe fruit. They were cowards. The Hexamon cannot judge us. He leaned forward and opened the box. Inside, the clavicle lay in many pieces. Some of them melted. Even after years, at the end of two projections within the shattered sphere, a tiny bit of glimmer showed. The last trace of a small, finite, artificial universe sympathetic with the way. None of the controls remained, however, and I saw it could never be repaired.
You were a fool to come here alone, Lenk said. Whoever sent you here was a fool. I have withstood Lamarckia and treachery and the devils of my own nature. I do not fear you or the Hexamon. Brian is dead, and that is a kind of waste, though he had too much of the Hexamon in him, and Baze is gone. So what are we to do, you and I?
I stared across the table at the man who had started all this, saw his weary defiance and his strength. I saw that Shirla was still in awe of him. He had his center of power, and the force necessary to oust him from that center would cause more bloodshed, and in the end, with all of Lamarckia changing, do nobody any good.
You've made a beginning for yourself, Lenk said. You've gathered a following. You could be like Brian, only I suspect you'd be a little colder than he was, and never trust someone like Baze. You could be formidable, Olmi.
I studied Lenk, and felt the remains of my hate dissolve, not because of any lessening of indignation and anger, but because he was part of a river of human history that could not be shifted without immense pain. He was not the worst, far from the best. But inevitably he was in his place, and for me to oppose him would be another kind of cruelty, not to him. He might relish the battle, but to his people, to Shirla. I could guarantee nothing. The Hexamon might never come, and I could not return to the way. My mission was over. After a moment, Link leaned back and said, "I thank you for what you've managed this far. I bless you for your work. You're a smart and decent man, Sir Olmi, but you are not like me and not like Brian. Go and live a life with this woman." I did not want my children on Lamarckia. Shirla wanted children. We compromised. Shirla and I lived in Athenai for 10 years. It was there we adopted our first boy, Rikka, one of the many orphans called Baze's children. I came in time almost to forget the Hexamon. For weeks on end, I thought little or nothing of my past. I was well known wherever we lived for being the Hexamon agent, but even in the worst of times, nobody resented me, or at least nobody expressed their resentments to me. The Adventists, what remained of them, came now and then, and Link did not oppose their coming. He knew I would not encourage them. When Link died, Alrika Facet took over the reins of power for a while, but the first starvation set in 5 years later, and she committed suicide. Others followed. The Devaricates kept their political scheme, and never did I sense a place for me in that scheme. For this, Shirla was grateful. We left Tasman after it began its own fluxing. We adopted our second son, Henrik, in Calcutta. As the years passed, more and more the change spread. So much of the beauty and variety of Lamarckia was fleeing before Brian's gift of green. What replaced it was simple and direct, tiny ecoi, covering only a few acres and getting tinier. Some of the scions, phytids, even mobile scions, seemed capable of independence, and perhaps even replicating on their own. Randall studied them closely and wrote more papers. We visited often. Shirla and I and our two sons had our happiest 5 years together in Jakarta. Batane's zone resisted the green longer than any but the island zones in the south, where most of the survivors clustered for decades. In those 5 good years, however, Jakarta became a wonderfully feverish city, an island of creative ferment and relative prosperity in the change. We actually saw Salop again. Yes, he had survived and was back at Wallace Station, but he made a trip to Jakarta. Many of us were dying from new immune challenges as Patane tried different defenses against Shia and the Green. Salop had been charting the spread of new scion chemistries, and he arrived when Shirla was very ill, making the trip especially to see us, I suppose, but also as part of the research effort. Shirla and I met with him in her room. Henrik and Rikka, ages 10 and 15, then came in and out carrying food, clean bedding, water. Shirla had become a real mother to them, and I had done my best in my distracted way to be a real father. Salop made his tests, took samples from her withered body, told us that there might be ways to turn back such challenges in a few months. Idle hopes, as it turned out. Salop finally related the story of his last few days with the female figure in the hemisphere. "She struggled to become human," he said, "having watched the Chung sisters and Brian, and finally paying close attention to me, the only model left to her, observing me while I observed her. We taught each other many things. But she could never think like us, much less understand our shapes. She was never more than a meticulous and crafty observer, without the cycling knot of self-awareness that must always separate us from the ecoi. At the last, though, she broke her second foot free and became independent for a few days. She managed to walk. She did pretty well under the circumstances." "What did she want?" Shirla asked. "The Ecos had observed humans having sex. It was curious about the process, thought it might result in another name, like Brian's gift of chlorophyll. She actually became seductive at the end. He stared at us, eyes flicking back and forth. For the first time, Salop seemed ill at ease.
"Did you?"
Sherla asked. Salop smiled and leaned his head to one side.
3 months after you left, the hemisphere withered, he continued. The last of the balloons had been manufactured and sent away with the winds.
What happened to her? To the imitation of Caitla? Sherla asked.
She withered, too. She maintained her interest to the end, trying to speak, trying to extract biological secrets, hoping for more gifts of names. Finally, she could not move, and she only made shrill whistles and rasping, barking sounds. When she died, I cut her open and studied her, but there was nothing particularly novel about her anatomy. I buried her beside the body of Caitla Chung in the New Silva.
She was a queen, Sherla said, and she swallowed and stared up at the matte fiber ceiling, and then looked at me.
You saw a true queen, Omi. I wish I could have seen her. I don't think we'll ever have that chance again.
Sherla died that winter. So many died that winter, as the weather itself changed and Patane began its final decline. The green arrived with its own disastrous spring, but by then I was a different man without Sherla. I flowed with the people, with Lenk's river of history. 34. I go with Janosch down the way in a flawship to the gate on the geometry stack. Transport ships are loading the last of the evacuees from Lamarckia. The situation there has become critical, and the Hexamon has ordered that all be removed. Because of the difficulties of a gate in the geometry stack, 15 years have passed since I was retrieved. Rebecca has died. All but 300 of the remaining 9,000 Lamarckians have been brought through the gate. My 2 sons are not among them. They have chosen to remain, to ride out the worst of the changes, though their chances of surviving are almost nil. Somehow I feel that I have given them a part of myself, made them like me, and done them no favor. I watch from a deltoid craft as the last of the Hexamon agents evacuate the gate. The gate is closing by itself, the stacks becoming unstable despite the best efforts of the best gate openers. The wall of the way glows brilliant violet, then flashes rich, vibrant green. The dimple fills and smooths over, and the surface assumes the color of fresh-cast bronze. The green flash lingers in my eye. I become who I am now.
35. This has been an Audible Frontiers production. Executive producer, Steve Feldberg. Producer, Mike Charzik and Stefan Rudnicki. Directed by Claire Bloom. Edited, mixed, and mastered by Ted Scott. Copyright 1995 by Greg Baer. Audio recording copyright 2012 by Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.